Hello and welcome back to Putting Town Centres First, a new podcast by the Heritage Council. In today's podcast, Jamie discusses the heritage sector in Scotland and also highlights the wide-ranging benefits for Scottish society. He discusses his role project managing a 2.4 million conservation area regeneration scheme in Aberdeen, City Heritage Trust, the Built Environment Forum Scotland and Scottish Civic Trust, who all work collaboratively and diligently to drive on the innovative heritage sector in Scotland. Please enjoy Jamie McNamara. Hello, folks. Today we are chatting with Jamie McNamara from Scotland Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings and also SPAB Ireland. Jamie, great to have you with us today. Just could I ask you to kick us off, start us off, what is your role in SPAB Scotland and SPAB Ireland? Like, what is your background and what's your experience?
Hi, Ali. Thanks for having me. Great to be here to yap all things buildings, which I love. The SPAB, the Society of Protection for Ancient Buildings, was set up way back in 1877 by a chap called William Morris and a few of his pals. And basically in response to the Victorianization of buildings and how they're being like repaired and fixed up to look pretty by damaging historic fabric. So I am the current chairperson of SPAB Scotland and been the chair for about a year now. I'm also an SPAB trustee, so I sit on the board and involved with the kind of high level decision making. And I've been involved with SPAB Ireland for about 2 or 3 years now back home. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to advocate, educate, look at casework, be a voice for buildings that don't have a voice, particularly back home in Ireland, where I really feel that, you know, there is room for us in this space and room for buildings to have a proper voice. And we're all volunteers. We all volunteer our time. We've got about 12 people on a committee here. Got about 12 people on the committee back home in Ireland. We're heavily involved in educating people, offering CPD events. Our annual working party is a great thing that we do. And we just bring together craftspeople to demonstrate the amazing craft skills that we have back home, from tinsmiths to lime work, timber work. It could be basket weaving, it could be soap making. It's along some kind of an indigenous craft skill.
Lovely. And Jamie, sorry, can I just ask you then? I mean, we should really mention that you're actually from the Republic of Ireland, shouldn't we?
Yeah, sorry, I'm actually from County Meath. I'm from my hometown is Trim, so quite a historic heritage town.
Lovely.
With castles and abbeys abound.
Can I ask you then, how did you get started in the heritage sector? Was it a calling for you, as it is with so many other people?
It was, but it was a calling that came later on in life. I mean, way back when, back in the dark ages, I've got an undergrad in business and finance, and I ended up working in corporate finance for about 15 years of my life. Don't ask me why, I was young and very impressionable. So I quit that back in about 2005, kind of wandered around aimlessly wondering what to do, became a TEFL teacher in Dublin, did an RHS certificate in horticulture, mm-hmm. wanted to become a garden designer, and I did flirt with that for a little bit. Ended up going to Chirk Castle to see their, over here in the UK, to see their very world famous gardens. But my eyes were drawn to the castle first and then the gardens. I was about 37 at the time, and I went, hang on a second. So long story short, came back home, did my applied building repair and conservation postgrad dip in Trinity College, tried desperately to get work back home in the field, couldn't get work, moved to the UK in 2014, ended up doing a master's in conservation, and then I'm now doing a second master's in building surveying, which I started recently. So that's how I got from, you know, point A to point B and my role in conservation right now.
Very interesting, Jamie. I mean, that's a bit of a journey, isn't it? You know, and obviously now you're immersed in sort of, you know, the built heritage sector. So you and I, we met actually lockdown. COVID was good for us because we met on LinkedIn online with a few others. Sarah, who's our previous podcast speaker. So yeah, quite a few of us sort of reached out during lockdown and have been sort of working together ever since. So that, I mean, there is a silver lining for this this pandemic. Can you just sort of give us a bit of an overview on the built heritage sector in Scotland? And really, you know, how does it differ from the sector in Ireland? I mean, you've mentioned that you're SPAB Scotland, SPAB Ireland. So you're in a really good position, you know, to see like what's going on and what are the gaps. So like, what do you think yourself?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's a dream of mine to get back home at some stage and maybe put my knowledge of conservation in the UK to good use back home and maybe to try to adopt some systems that we have here that we don't have back home. I just think, to some eyes, whatever, I think heritage is taken more seriously here in Scotland. It's seen for its economic benefits. It's seen for its placemaking, its well-being. It's seen for how people engage with heritage. And I've got some quite incredible statistics that I will impart with you later on about the money and the attractions of that here. But things like the CARS scheme, like the Conservation Area Regeneration Scheme, for example, £68 million has been directly input into our built environment here over since around 2007. We have like robust legislation. We've got seven city heritage trusts who all have delegated powers around the whole country of Scotland to invest money within the direct built environment. We've got funding streams. We've got the likes of the Development Trust Association of Scotland. We've got the Heritage Trust Network. We've got BEFS, which is the Built Environment Forum of Scotland, which is a collaborative voice of those who've got a vested interest within heritage to allow that voice then to be heard directly with government and to have a direct influence on policy making and legislation and actually bringing to fruition ideas in our heritage sector here. As I said, we've got the SPAB that I'm a member of. We've been here in Scotland for 25 years now. We have the IHBC, the Institute of Historic Building Conservation, that I'm a full member of. We've got the Scottish Mentoring Networks. We've got the Engine Shed, which is run by HES, which focuses primarily on traditional crafts and traditional skills and training the next generations. We've got robust apprenticeship schemes. We've got the Scottish Civic Trust that represents heritage outlets from a civic perspective and placemaking around the country, particularly with a really good input into the diverse heritage aspect. Oh,
sorry, that Scottish Civic Trust, is that
Scottish
a national?
Civic Trust.
That's a national
body, yeah. Okay, and that's my current employer who I actually work for.
Yeah.
And wow. So my job there is to mentor what I actually do on a day-to-day basis. I mentor groups all over the country of Scotland, from the Isle of Skye to Inverness, on how to get their wonderful historic asset or project from an idea around a kitchen table to a point where they might get funding for one of many, many funding streams here in Scotland.
Okay, so you like, it sounds like your systems are very well, you know, set up, that they're very well developed, you know, they're embedded, the systems, the policy, the structures, you know, maybe something that we don't really have as much in Ireland and that we're all sort of trying to collaborate to sort of work out where are the gaps and what do we need to do. And that in Built Environment Forum Scotland is definitely a model that we, as you know, you set up a meeting for us with myself and Sarah Sherlock and Nikki Matthews and yourself and Ewan Lynch. So, I mean, that's really, that's been really important for us to sort of reach out and see what kind of organisations do we need to set up in Ireland. You know, in terms of the sort of benefits, you touched on it there at the start, of the heritage sector, like they're very well understood in Scotland. And I feel that that's possibly missing in Ireland. I think we all have been talking about this during the lockdown. You know, it's about value and sort of awareness. So what do you think we need to do in Ireland to sort of, you know, learn from that?
Yeah, I would agree, Ali. I think we have an opportunity. I think COVID has been difficult for many, many reasons, but I do see this particular time of our life to be used as an opportunity to really regenerate our historic buildings and learn from our peers across here in Scotland. A couple of reports that I will refer to in terms of, like, you know, one is called the Our Place in Time, OPIT. Our Place in Time is kind of a strategy for the historic environment here in Scotland. And it's also like a vision of like where it currently is and where it's going to be over the coming years. But it's also done collaboratively, which is the key word. I mean, like, we've all got lots of buzzwords at working together and, you know, trying to get away from silo working. But here it happens. Here it works. Here we don't have that relationship-based political way as such, whatever.
Sure.
As I said earlier on about the historic environment is taken seriously. So like in the kind of the OPIT report, there's four kind of key areas. So like we got the cross-cutting strategic priorities. That's when we take the culture, the society and the environment and the economic value of heritage to the individual community all over the country. We understand it through investigating and recording the historic environment. And then we disseminate that educationally through all, you know, demographics across the country. We protect our heritage. We protect the historic environment to both enjoy and benefit from that. And we share it. We share the significance and the richness of the whole thing, whatever. And a very interesting extract is in terms of like the historic environment, it provides a backdrop to people's daily lives. And that's really to the fore. It's not seen as an addendum or an add-on or something
it's
fluffy.
It's a platform, isn't it? It's a platform for everybody.
It actually is. And it's there in monetary values and economic values. And I just give a couple of stats here, which is really interesting in terms of, we have these reports done in Scotland. Every couple of years, these reports are updated and refreshed going back decades. For example, in the construction sector here in Scotland, I mean, 33% of the industry's annual, almost 10 billion turnover comes from the repair and maintenance of the historic built environment for pre-1919 buildings. We got, like, in terms of the strategy, as I mentioned earlier, we got 4.2 billion of Scotland's economy is generated from its historic environment, which equates to about 66,000 full-time jobs across the sector. Caveat, obviously, with COVID, we're not quite sure what's going to happen. But like, and I mentioned some grant schemes earlier, and £1.2 billion has been paid out since about 2014 to pay for historic building repair. You know, the likes of the National Lottery Heritage Fund, we have Historic Environment Scotland, local authorities, the National Trusts, and the Heritage Trusts, which I mentioned as well. It's about understanding what we have here. Like, one in five people live in a pre-1919 building. And I keep mentioning pre-1919. It's just the conservation cutoff of what is and what isn't an old building, shall we say. And we have about 56,000 historic buildings. We've got a buildings at risk register, so we know exactly what's being recorded. I know Sarah will like that one. So we can really show what is, where it's at in terms of condition, condition reports, how at risk it is. And so we know then exactly what we can do in terms of reaching these identifiers in terms of the numbers and figures, and making sure that we can, if we know, for example, that 67% of all of our pre-1919 buildings need some maintenance, we know there's a supply and demand for the right skill sets to fix those buildings. Yeah. And these data sets is what we need back home. We need this.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's one of the things that we're trying to create with the CTCHC program, is to sort of try and set up the recognition that you need data, you know, and that you need information, and you need quantitative and you need qualitative. So, you know, one of the things that you and I and Sarah and Nikki have talked about quite often over the last few months was, you know, that you have a definition of what is the historic environment in Scotland in your national planning framework. And I mean, I think that that's kind of missing in the Irish system, you know, that sort of environment and its value and its benefits, it's not really actually articulated anywhere. And, you know, and I think until we get that, you know, that you have in Scotland, and we've sort of talked to you jealously about, you know, that that's so recognised.
I've worked in public authority over here in Scotland, and I've worked within the planning function of a public authority. So I can see that the conservation officers within that function are embedded, and they're a crucial part of that function. They have to comment on whether it's an A, B, or C listed building or an unlisted building of, you know, historic importance to an area. And then again, those key buildings, maybe A and B of listed buildings, then go to a higher authority for HES to maybe have an input on.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, it's not a case of like, let's go ask the conservation person about something. They are part of the process from start to finish. And these people are qualified to a master's level, IHBC qualified, have CPD coming out of their yin yang, and are a part of the real process of giving, as I said in my intro, giving a voice to the historic built environment. And it's no good like having it as an add-on. It's got to be embedded. And until we've done the study together about the lack of conservation officers back home, the lack of the ACOs back home, and local authorities that don't have them are at a severe disadvantage. And the buildings that they administer are at a severe disadvantage. So yeah. It's in our best interest to make sure that we do put the right people in those right posts so buildings can then benefit.
I think that's right. I mean, if you don't have the resources and you don't have the expertise, and I mean, you know, I'm thinking of Dundalk and Drogheda, where there is no conservation officer in the local authority, you know, like how are we meant to unlock this issue? You know, in terms of how do we move on? So yeah, I mean, the programme for government includes repurposing officers. So I mean, the conservation officers, like, instead of people thinking it's a head wrecker, you know, it needs to be sort of an incentive, doesn't it? And I think we're all keen to try and sort of turn that around so that it's seen as, you know, that the historic environment is a benefit and not a disadvantage. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, I gave you some key numbers there in terms of how much money, direct, you know, money in terms of the it generates for the economy. But if we're going to, when I fly home to Dublin and I walk through the airport and I see lovely pictures of castles and, you know, the Blarney Stone and all that lovely stuff, whatever, which is brilliant. But I mean, and as I said, you know, my hometown is Trim and it's got heritage, you know, dripping. It's dripping with heritage. I mean, the OPW are in Trim, but, you know, Trim could be doing much better for itself as a town centre, which is, you know, it's got the historic fabric at its core, as many of our town centres do. And we need to flip this whole thing in our head. We need to disrupt the whole supply and demand. We need to look at our old buildings as assets, as regenerative assets, and not as liabilities, whatever. And then the whole thing is kind of like a chicken and egg and a whole snowball effect. We create the supply and demand, we shake it up, and then we need the right skill sets. I know great tinsmiths back home. I know fantastic lime workers. I know amazing stonemasons. We're crying out for work. We're crying out for the right jobs to do. And we have the buildings. We can rival Scotland. There's no reason why we can't rival Scotland. just need to get our proverbial fingers out and do it.
Yeah, and I think we need to have targets, you know, to sort of set those targets for the reusing of those traditional buildings. And then that leads us on nicely to sort of jobs and employment creation. I mean, obviously with this pandemic, and there's been some, you know, there's been a lot of kind of pressure on jobs, employment, whatever, you know, there is an opportunity there for traditional skills to come to the fore. And I mean, I know, Jimmy, you feel really passionately about this. And, you know, I talked with Nikki about this in terms of what skills are we actually talking about. But what is possible there for our town centres, all those buildings, the vacancy rates are very high. You know, how do we get those skills? How do we get people into that employment sector?
Yeah, no, it's something that I am passionate about. I mean, I was very fortunate to work in a heritage training centre in North Yorkshire for a while in England. And I was directly involved in taking, like, I can't say young kids because we had an apprentice who was 49 at the time and a great guy called Matt. And we trained these young kids up and people in like wood occupations and stone occupations for anything from like lime mortars to cob buildings to joinery to carpentry to lime washing and all to do with historic built environments. So as I said to you before, we have the palette of buildings all over our country. We just need to disrupt the supply and demand. I mean, I am sick to the back teeth of this whole myopic viewpoint of conservation deficits. You know, buildings are not economically viable to fix because it's too expensive to do them the right way. But that's very narrow-minded. It's a lazy attitude because we need to think of them as placemaking, as job creation, as regeneration, as well-being, as sustainable, hitting our green agenda targets, hitting our carbon output targets. You know, making, you know, if we're going to say things like the 15-minute city or the 15-minute town, whatever, let's do it. We have the buildings. We've got vacancy rates, which are way higher than other places in Europe. We've got the stock. We've got enthusiasm. We've got, like, we're a country of hands-on workers. You know, we have a history of building our own.
Absolutely. The hands that built America. You know, I keep thinking about that. Can we not rebuild Ireland's town centres, you know?
But exactly. I remember doing my thesis in Dublin and Trinity, whatever, and there was a lot of, going back through all like 1940s, 1950s records in the archives, there's a lot of anger towards the Georgian heart of Dublin because they were seen as, you know, an English representation. But I was there, oh, hang on a second. They were built by the Irish hand, though. You know what I mean? You know, our dads and granddads built these fine lumps. So, like, why can't we do that again? So I think we've got to shake up the supply and demand. We've got to look at our regeneration of our cities and no more talk. Just look at them as assets to regenerate. And if you create that demand, you therefore create your supply, which is the tradesperson.
Yeah. And I think we're really focused on that, aren't we, for 2021, all of us who are involved in this podcast series. You know, we really want to look at job creation and trying to sort of retrain people and see, are there any, you know, skill sets there that people that have been suffering really quite badly during the pandemic can benefit from this, can benefit from regenerating our town centres. You know, there's so many benefits that need to be explained. It's not really, you know, it is a communications issue as well that we need to get them.
I agree with that, Ali, completely. And ourselves, SPB Ireland, whenever we champion the craftspeople of Ireland, as I said, our annual working party, we have an open day towards the end of it, where we invite craftspeople to come and demonstrate the skills for free. So the public can engage with these people to find out what a thatcher does or what a tinsmith might do or what like a lead worker actually does, and try to, you know, open people's eyes that these are viable trades, viable jobs. You know what I mean? There are other avenues that we can use to fix our historic building stock.
Absolutely. And the Heritage Council, I mean, it's a perfect match for the Heritage Council, which is why, you know, for us, town centres are just so, so important, historic town centres. And just moving on, you mentioned conservation area regeneration schemes at the start. And also, I know you're involved heavily, you were a manager, project manager in the one in Aberdeen. Can you just tell us about what did you do? And, you know, like, tell our listeners about, you know, in terms of the benefits, what you were involved in.
Yeah, I'll kind of just quickly go on, whatever. Well, the CARR scheme, so the Conservation Area Regeneration Scheme, which is kind of funded, the one I did in Aberdeen was about a £2.4 million budget. So I had, my budget was £2.4 million for one street. So think about that for the numbers I've been bandied about lately back home in terms of Ireland-wide grants. So then the scheme was about fixing historic buildings in a certain area of a conservation area in Aberdeen. So I would, like, you know, engage with homeowners and stakeholders of historic buildings. We'd pay for the likes of lead repairs, sash and case window repairs, stone repairs, lime pointing, etc. But also a part of the money was about training. So we offered like a suite of free training programs across the whole gambit, again, like window repairs, lead work, lime work, that we would make available to homeowners, stakeholders, and contractors who come to us and learn these key skills for free. we also took on two young apprentices as part of the legacy of that funding scheme. So then two young kids with a local contractor would then be the next generation to take on the skill set from the CAR scheme. And CAR has been running for about 2007, and I think there's £68 million, I think it's been directly linked or fed into the historic built environment, because that's used also then to leverage public money. So if I give a grant of like 60% or 70%, also for shop fronts as well, that other 25 or 30, 40% is there from, it's from private money. So you're leveraging the public incentive to get the building fixed. So we're also then allowing people to understand the historic built environment, you know, why are we...
And that's all based on a conservation area designation. I mean, so that could be done in Ireland straight away.
That could be done in Ireland anywhere, you know what I mean? Because it's linked, it's government funded. So we had, as a 1.2 million from HES, we had 1.2 million roughly from our local authority, and then 50,000 from our local BID, which is amazing. So we had like the buy-in of business as well. So it was a really collaborative way to make people aware. And we had like, we got the kids involved. We got like, I did an amazing project with like about 600 or 700 school children to design shop fronts on Union Street. And when you get young people designing shop fronts, they did shops that sold UFOs and shops that sold horses, and it was all sorts of crazy
skateboards.
But it was fun though. So then those kids would then engage with their parents, and they felt part of the whole process. Yeah. It wasn't detached in terms of, oh, that's just another council thing, or that's just another public
that
money.
Sounds fabulous, Jamie. And maybe we could share, you know, as part of your podcast, some links to that, because I mean, anything that sort of uses the conservation area designation would be really beneficial, because I don't think it's been used at all in Ireland as a tool for regeneration. Then in terms of City Heritage Trusts, those are well established. You mentioned them as well earlier. Can you just tell us maybe a bit about those? I mean, they sound, it just all sounds so fascinating, what's going on in Scotland.
I know, and this is just another arm. And I was lucky enough to work for the local City Heritage Trust here in Glasgow. And so basically there's 7 City Heritage Trusts around Scotland, one in each major city: Aberdeen, Dundee, Glasgow, Stirling, Inverness, Perth, Edinburgh, and Glasgow. So basically they're kind of delegated from HES to fund them, and they get a, you know, varying amounts of money. And I worked in Glasgow City Heritage Trust, and I looked after the building repair grants. So I had roughly about £900,000 to pay out in building repairs. Similar to a CAR scheme, they were directly linked, but out with of just conservation areas. This was kind of encompassing the whole city of Glasgow to pay for like tenement repair, roof repairs, communal repairs, window repairs, historic tile work repairs. And we could give a grant of up to £100,000 per address. So they're quite substantial amounts of money to pay for these buildings. I think these have also been going for about 15 years now, the City Heritage Trusts. And in the period between 2018 and 21, which is just coming into, £8.6 million has been directly invested in the historic built environment across those cities. And again, that money is used to leverage the private money going into it as well. So it also creates jobs. We offered CPD events and training. We gave money for feasibility reports, where somebody might have an old building and would say, right, we can give you a grant of £7,000 to engage with an architect to come up with a feasibility for that building. But it also allows then us to offer free information across the whole of the country. So people can take away the fear of old buildings are the problem, or it's drafty, or I can't do this. But yeah, so that was a really, really good scheme.
And Jamie, I think as well, like, you know, if you have those structures, then the funding can go into those structures. Whereas if you don't have the structures, then there's no way of getting the funding into the buildings or into those areas or the streets. Do you know what I mean? I find that quite puzzling, you know, because I've been saying for many years that we need new structures to funnel that funding and that leverage that you've been talking about, you know, and then you can't create it if it doesn't exist. You know, you have to set up obviously new structures, looking at what Scotland, you know, what is the best practice, what works over there. So I mean, everything you're talking about today is just so important for Ireland as we sort of look back to our town centres and try to sort of take back our town centres and try to fix them. I was really taken with Scotland and Ireland. They signed, we signed a bilateral agreement late last year, and I had actually booked Phil Prentice from Scotland's Towns Partnership to come and do a workshop, and asked him would he come over before that bilateral agreement was signed. So I was delighted when I heard about it, because I mean, obviously, we play rugby and whatever, and those are always great matches, great games. There's a great sort of camaraderie there between the Irish and the Scottish. You know, are you sort of hopeful that there will be mentoring, you know, that we'll be able to sort of exchange on, like, how do you measure your socioeconomic benefits, all the stuff that you've talked about, you know, the benefits?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a great believer in fate, but I think the fact that you and I linked on LinkedIn randomly 6 months ago, I think there's a higher purpose to this, Ali. Let's be honest, right? And I think this is probably the higher purpose. and I really do think that, you know, now is the time to really learn from our peers, to learn from Scotland. And this is where I'm going to mention BEFS here, the Built Environment Forum of Scotland, because, you know, Ewan Leach is a wonderful human being and a very knowledgeable gentleman in terms of the historic built environment. And he's spoken to yourself and Sarah and Nikki and myself and further conversations to come. But what BEFS do, they're kind of an umbrella organization for the built environment of Scotland. They're membership led. So it's not a case that they're just built environment. They have members such as archaeology, the Heritage Network, planners, you know, the IHBC, SPAB, National Trust for Scotland, Civic Trust, the churches, landscape and gardens. So everybody is there underneath this umbrella. And so basically they then will unite these members. So they will have informing or informal discussions about legislation. They will then, you know, discuss ways that their sector can be represented at the highest level in government. And they can advocate, and then the BEFS will advocate on behalf of their members directly to Holyrood here with the government.
Yeah, and they advise on policy. I think that's what Ewan was,
They've advised directly on policy. Mm. So like, it's not a case, that, so there's, they're taking that detachment of policy from, you know, some organization who maybe, you know, feel underrepresented, say in the West Coast of Ireland, become a member of the likes of BEFS, and they will talk directly to government to get your voice. It's not about, of course, they may have competing agendas, but the agendas are coherent in terms of the well-being of the country and the well-being of how a member's particular agenda can work for the betterment of Scotland through the medium of BEFS. And this is something that I am just so keen, along with you, Ali, and other members, to get this bad boy off the ground back home. Because
yeah, I think we've been talking about this with you, and obviously, you know, the podcast series is a good way to sort of show the collaboration and what is possible when you bring all these wonderful sectors and people together. So, I mean, I would see the podcast series as being the first step in trying to move towards that model of a BEFS in Ireland. And it's a very exciting thing, as you say, Jamie, because it's that sort of united voice. And at the minute, the voice is just not being heard for the heritage sector. Can I just ask you then, in terms of Ireland's programme for government, it came out in June. We were obviously pushing quite heavily for Town Centres First, which is now included. The CTCHC programme is included, which is wonderful for a programme that started with no budget. As I've said, most of the podcasts, you know, the first year we had no funding. And obviously we do now, and we have a massive waiting list. So one of the actions as well is the Irish diaspora, which you and myself and Nikki and Sarah have spoken at length about, you know, because we feel that there's a massive opportunity for our heritage sector to talk to people like yourself and other Irish people who are part of the diaspora. You know, do you want to tell us about your thoughts? Because I know you've very strong feelings on this one, haven't you?
Yeah, no, this is my baby, I suppose. I'm really, really keen to get this off the ground because, like, as I said, through every kind of crisis, there's always an opportunity. And I feel now is the opportunity to look at our buildings and our town centres with, you know, people working from home and maybe reevaluating the importance of the local areas, etc., to utilise skill sets that we don't have back home just yet. I mean, we should all have a little hard look at what we don't have and try to learn from others, I think. And this diaspora is the perfect catalyst for that. And talking with people that I know throughout Scotland, Wales and England, from all walks of life in terms of the conservation sphere and all levels within that sphere, from directorship level to like senior management to people with the hands-on trades to education, conservation officers, conservation consultants, academia. And they're all so keen to lend a voice to back home. It's not a case of we're going to tell you how it should be. Mm-hmm. It's about finding a system that works for Ireland. What works for what our heritage means, what it means to us, our significance, which is crucially important to keep that to the fore as well. But now is the time to learn from people who have done it, who have run systems, who are embedded in a conservation area over here, which, you know, it's not without its own flaws, but it's been proven to work over many, many years. And if we can take the learnings from this one, we can use our buildings and get them to work for us in terms of regenerating money, placemaking, make our towns habitable again and fun places to be, and get away that commuter Dublin centric attitude. And, you know, why can't I go and live in a town down country? Why can't I have everything there as opposed to having to travel 2 hours to a city or whatever?
And it's also an opportunity for the diaspora to possibly come home, because as you say, if that sort of, you know, change in the commuting patterns or whatever, and people are able to work from home now and can live in smaller towns or whatever, instead of doing the big commute up to the cities. I mean, I think you and I and Sarah, Nikki, whatever, quite a few of us, this programme for government, we were really sort of taken by the diaspora, because we've all worked and lived away from home. We've got off the island. You know, some people are off the island for different reasons, but it's really just to harness that knowledge, isn't it? That shared knowledge of the Irish diaspora.
Yeah, and it's funny. I put a shout out, you know, kind of an informal shout out to people, and the enthusiastic feedback I got was overwhelming. You know, I'm like, Jamie, where do I sign? Where do I sign? I'm really happy to give my worth. And I know people who want to come home. I know people who want to come home and like bring their skills back home. And there are people here that want to help. And if we can get those brains home, you know, why can't we put in the systems? Why can't we be enthusiastic for the future? I mean, why can't we have our own BEFs? Why can't we have St. Harris Trust?
I know. I mean, absolutely. It's just a wonderful time. And the whole sort of the one good thing about the lockdown is that people have reconnected with their places and their town centres. And absolutely, I think people are seeing their buildings now, you know, if they're vacant, they're wondering, you know, look at that beautiful building, you know, how come it's been empty for 15 years? So, and I mean, I think that is the problem now. And a lot of our vacant buildings have been vacant for quite a long time. So, you know, we do need to look at the building stock, and we need to talk to the diaspora, because those people have been doing it. If that building's been vacant for 15 years, nothing has really happened with the building. So we need the diaspora. That's how I feel, you know. I'm delighted it's in the programme for government.
Yeah, no, I think if we just kind of take the whole reframe it from a solution-finding perspective as opposed to dwelling on problems. I mean, the vacant building for me is a potential home. A vacant building is a potential commercial unit. A vacant building is a potential area regeneration. A vacant building is a learning platform for traditional skills. You know, I can go on all day for what it can be.
I think that's the sort of issue. You know, we look at vacant buildings and go, the possibility, and we don't see it as a problem. It's more like, you know, help us to fix the gaps, help us to fix this system so we don't have the vacancy levels that we have. And I mean, the programme for government, you know, I'm as excited as you are and the others are in the podcast series of getting stuck into the programme for government in early 2021 and trying to see, you know, what is possible for our town centres, for our traditional heritage, the buildings, traditional buildings and town centres. So, Jamie, I look forward. I mean, obviously, you've got lots of stats that we need to sort of create in Ireland, and we need to start to measure things, because you only value things that are measured. And if it's not measured, then it's not going to be valued. So I think, you know, in terms of January, February, it's going to be another crazy few months, I would say, as we try to sort of keep moving. We try to keep creating and building. And that's really what we're trying to do, isn't it? You know, to build a sector that's really fit for purpose to fix our town centres. Okay, Jamie, I'm just going to ask you this question that I ask all the podcast speakers. So if you could do one thing for Irish town centres, what would it be?
It's a really good question, this, Ali. And I probably have already answered it, but I'll say it again because I think it needs to be said. I would really love to disrupt our viewpoints of our town centres. I really want to shake up the whole supply and demand of our town centres. We need to reframe them as opportunities. I mean, we look back in history of, like, you know, the Celtic Tiger, where town centres had, like, you know, ghost estates and bypasses, and they were like just dying on their rear end, let's be honest. Whereas now we need to look at them when people have re-engaged with them, as you've rightly said. Why not look at them and shake up that supply and demand model? We have the supply of historic buildings. We've got buildings from the West Coast, East Coast, North and South, and all in between. We've got historic fabric everywhere you look in Ireland, in our villages and our towns, and of course our cities. But why not then look at the wider picture of getting our diaspora involved to find solutions for these town centres? Look at the likes of, you know, the training centres that I've worked for, and the model of the Building Craft College in London, and how they really, really push the traditional skills agenda and use our buildings as training platforms, as, you know, as examples or and exemplars of good regeneration. Why can't we have a conservation area regeneration scheme? Why can't we look at government funding and have that delegated towards city trusts or town trusts? Why can't we have BIDs all over the country? Why can't we have free training and CPD events in these town centres? We need to educate people that these buildings and these town centres are opportunities. They're not empty, vacant buildings. They're opportunities. So I want to reframe it and for us to start doing in 2021. That's what I want for our town centres.
Jimmy, that's wonderful. I mean, it is all part of the enabling process, because if we, you know, upskill these people, then they're more likely to take on the buildings if they don't know the skills, if they don't know anybody. It's all about that network and that collaboration and trying to, I mean, I can't see how we're going to fix our buildings unless we do the traditional skills, do you know?
Exactly. I know with the SPAB Ireland, you know, we're only in the game 2 or 3 years, but we're always championing good traditional craftspeople and skilled people who want to do this work. And they do exist. They are there. They're all over the country. They're everywhere. We just need to harness them and make them, you know, make them our new superheroes of Ireland towns.
We need to create a movement, don't we? You know,
we do.
Ursula von der Leyen's talking about a new Bauhaus movement. And I think that as part of that, yeah. We need to have a new traditional skills movement in Ireland and really just get going and trying to harness all the work that you've been doing with others. SPAB Ireland, SPAB Scotland, you know, not reinvent the wheel. People are doing this for 20 years or more. And we just need to get stuck in. Really, isn't that it?
We've had Irish hands building our town centres for generations and generations. You know what I mean? We just need to rejig it a bit and reinvigorate. That's what we need.
And lots of support from the government with the programme for
exactly,
government.
Exactly, exactly.
Thank you, as always, Jamie, for all the contacts that you've put us in touch with in Scotland, the Irish diaspora, and it's just going to grow and grow. And we really want to reach out to the Irish diaspora. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to Jamie. Whoa, that is very impressive. What a heritage sector. The systems, the structures, the measuring of the benefits, it's all just wonderful. It's clearly a national model to be truly proud of. This episode is dedicated to Martin McNamara.